Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, we are, Your Honor. May I very quickly introduce my co-counsel, Rochelle Silverberg, from the Wachtell Lipton firm, who is here today on behalf of PNC Financial Services, Inc., and will present argument on behalf of all defendants below.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning. Steve Norman for the National City Defendants. I'd like to introduce Jack Newman of the Jones Day firm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning. May it please the court, Brian Long from Rogrodsky and Long in Wilmington, Delaware, here on behalf of plaintiffs below, appellees, and on behalf of cross appellants. I'd like to introduce my partner at council table with me today, Seth Rogrodsky.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Berger, Rick Miller from the Wilmington firm, Ferry Joseph and Pierce, here on behalf of the appellants, objectors below, the McCall objectors, and the Vadas objectors. With me at counsel's table are Frank Bettini from San Diego, representing the McCall objectors, and Edward Cochran, representing the Vadas objectors. Mr. Bettini will be presenting argument first, to be followed by Mr. Cochran, and then we'll be also yielding to Mr. Nackbar, who is going to be sharing our time. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the court. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think the clerk explained to you how the clock's going to work. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Frank Bottini for the appellants. I'd like to focus on three arguments this morning. The first is a due process objection that was raised by my clients, the appellants, regarding the lack of adequacy of the named plaintiffs and their counsel. Pursuant to Prezant versus De Angelis, the Chancellor failed to make the explicit findings on the record as to compliance with Rule 23. Therefore, the case should be reversed and remanded to the Chancellor on that grounds. Second, the court applied an erroneous legal standard to approval of the settlement because the Chancellor did not value the federal law claims asserted by my clients in federal court in Ohio when weighing the alleged benefits of the settlement compared to the value of the claims. The Chancellor only valued the Delaware state law breach of fiduciary duty claims. Therefore, it was an erroneous standard and should be reversed. Finally, with respect to the approval of the settlement, the Chancellor abused the discretion because the court did not properly value the claims and also that the alleged benefit, the additional disclosures, were meager, minuscule, and immaterial as found by the Chancellor. The settlement of a class action which does not provide the right to opt out, as this settlement did not, implicates important and substantial due process rights protected by the 14th Amendment. This court noted that in the Nottingham Partners case, and in the Prezant versus De Angelis case, this court said that in every class action case, the trial court must make explicit findings of fact on the record as to the compliance with Rule 23, because that is the only way that absent class members, such as my clients, are protected, is through the adequacy of representation. That did not happen here. It's undisputed that that did not happen. In the July 31st, 2009 order, the Chancellor made no findings of fact with respect to Rule 23. Also, in Prezant, this court held that not only must the court make explicit findings of fact, the court must make detailed reasons when there's an objection. If there's no objection to the settlement, on due process grounds, the court can just make the findings. But when there are objections, as my clients, Mr. Vadas and Mr. Rocker, made on adequacy of representation grounds, the court must provide detailed supporting reasoning to facilitate appellate review. That was not done here. Secondly, the court applied an erroneous legal standard because, again, the Chancellor did not weigh the benefits of the federal proxy claims asserted by my clients in federal court in Ohio. In the July 31st, 2009 order approving the settlement, Chancellor Chandler indicated that the breach of fiduciary duty claims asserted by the plaintiffs in the court below were weak. And on that grounds, the meager and minuscule benefits represented by the disclosures were allegedly sufficient to approve the settlement. But again, in the July 31st order, the Chancellor did not make any evaluation of the federal proxy claims asserted by my clients.
Tell us about those claims. Did they have a monetary value?
Yes, those claims were worth in excess of $1.1 billion.
How did you arrive at that?
That valuation is based on the conservative estimate of Citigroup, which was the financial advisor for PNC. Citigroup performed a discounted cash flow analysis, unlike the investment banker for NCC, which was Goldman Sachs, which failed to perform a DCF analysis. According to the DCF analysis performed by Citigroup, the value of NCC stock was somewhere between, we have it in our brief, was somewhere between $2 and over $3 per share as opposed to $2.23.
And in developing your claims, did you come across evidence to suggest that someone would have come in with a higher offer?
There was, first of all, one of the problems which goes to adequacy of representation is that the claims were not fully developed in the trial court. There was one deposition taken before the settlement was reached, and there were two depositions taken after the settlement was reached.
Oh, I know the inadequacies you're alleging with respect to what was done in this case. What I want you to develop for the court is the strength of your case that the Chancellor decided could be extinguished. So my question for you is, what record evidence did you develop in your case that more money could have been realized?
Well, in our case, the case was basically stayed when the settlement was reached, so we weren't allowed to conduct a discovery. So the record that we have as the value of the claims goes to the de minimis record that exists in the Chancery Court. Now,
I understand that, but it's one thing to say something has a value. It's another thing to get somebody to pay the value. So my question for you is, you made a decision to file suit based on some evidence, and you would have enhanced it if you would have gotten discovery. My question is, what evidence is in your claim that this significant monetary value you attribute to the claim could have actually been realized because someone else would have come in and paid more money?
Well, there was substantial evidence that NCC had a significantly greater value as a standalone entity. Goldman Sachs did not perform a standalone value. It only performed a liquidation value.
No, I understand that, and I'll only ask this one more time, and then I won't take up your argument time. My question is, were you able to identify one or more entities that were willing to pay more money?
There were several entities that were interested in buying the company. There was Wells Fargo, there was Scotiabank, there were several other entities that are identified in the record that wanted to buy NCC. As to the issue of the value, one of the main issues was whether the defendants kept relying upon was this speculative crisis of liquidity that might occur. Well, the thing that's in the record is that the defendants never applied for the TARP funds.
Well, but we have a sequence here where there was a figure, and PNC came in and topped that figure. And once PNC came in, nobody else appeared. So my question for you is, given the chronology, this continuum, if your claim really has value, you have to be able to demonstrate somebody would have appeared that didn't appear, wouldn't you?
Or we have to prove that the directors shouldn't have sold the company at this price. Again, there's significant evidence in the record that greater value could have been realized by maintaining the independence of the company. They could have applied for the TARP funds. Every of the top 25 largest U.S. banks, every single bank received TARP funds against NCC. When the representatives in Ohio complained to Congress and the Treasury Department, why was NCC singled out as the only major bank among the top 25 that didn't get TARP funds? That was Representative Stephen Latourette. The Treasury responded they couldn't find any record of NCC ever having applied for the TARP funds. So the directors breached their fiduciary duties by never applying for the TARP funds and then relying almost exclusively on the fact that NCC might have faced a liquidity crisis when The Treasury announced the recipients of the TARP funds on October 24th, the same day the merger was announced, had they not gotten the funds. Well, you can't get the funds if you never apply for them.
Isn't there record evidence that I believe on October 19th, NCC was told explicitly that it wouldn't get the funds and that it should look elsewhere?
It was suggested to NCC, I think is what the record says. But again, there was never any formal determination by the Treasury. And more importantly, NCC had never applied for the funds. So if NCC had applied for the funds, they could have stated the case as to why they should receive it. And again, directors owe fiduciary duties to the shareholders, not to government regulators. So that is in the record that supports the fact there was...
Are you saying that the fiduciary duty claim turns on whether or not there was a formal application for TARP funds, when the record shows that informally the board was told, don't even bother applying?
Well, I think the record was very undeveloped on that issue, Your Honor.
Yes, it may be undeveloped, but, on that difference turns whether or not there's a viable fiduciary duty claim, if I understand your position correctly.
Again, Your Honor, but I think we're getting far afield of the legal issue that's before the court today.
If we are, it's because we're just following up on arguments you're making.
Well, again, my argument was that the chancellor committed an error because he applied the wrong legal standard. The chancellor made no evaluation of the federal proxy claims.
All right. And if he had done that, what would he have determined, in your view?
In the July 31st order, the chancellor said that the value of the state law Delaware breach of fiduciary duty claims was weak because the directors were entitled to a business judgment rule defense.
Right. The additional disclosures that constituted the consideration for the settlement were meager, if that's the right word. Weak claims, weak consideration, but fair value on both sides. Your argument is, hey, wait a minute. You know, we have a securities action out in Ohio, and you've ignored that. So my question is, if the chancellor had not ignored it and proceeded to try to give that Ohio securities claim some value, what would he have come up with?
Again, as we indicated in our papers, over $1 billion, we believe, was the value. The
securities claim is a disclosure claim, correct?
It's a Section 14A claim.
And you're saying that you would have recovered $1 billion in that Ohio securities claim?
Again, we don't have to prove that what we would have recovered. The Delaware law is clear that if the claims have color, and if they're not inherently meritless claims, the court has to give some credence to them when faced with the fact that the plaintiffs are releasing that claim for zero consideration.
Well, you're saying the claim was worth $1 billion. Then when I ask you for particulars, you tell me that you don't have to give them, that all you have to do is show that there's color.
Well,
but this is a judge who's in a position of having to value claims for purposes of determining the fairness of a settlement. Now, what is it that the judge is supposed to do?
Well, the judge was required to value them. The judge can use its discretion to do that, but it did not do it here. And again, the proxy law claims are not subject to a business judgment rule defense. They're not subject to exculpatory provision. And those were the two main bases that the chancellor relied upon for saying that the Delaware state law claims are weak. So it should have been taken into consideration when weighing the benefits of the settlement, which, again, the chancellor admitted were de minimis and meager. And I think this case is very similar to the MCA case, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Between the court and your argument, we've used up all your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, Edward Cochran. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Rather than this argument, in the interest of economy and given the usage of time, I'm going to reserve the time allotted to me for rebuttal.
Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Nackbar on behalf of Fiduciary Counselors, Inc., which objected to the proposed award of attorney's fees in the settlement. We do not contest the propriety of the settlement, but address only the cross-appeal of plaintiff's counsel, which seeks to challenge as unfairly low the $400,000 that was awarded, and instead seeks an award of $1.2 million. We were frankly shocked that plaintiff's counsel took this cross-appeal, and more shocked at the tone of the cross-appeal, which accused the chancellor of abuse of discretion, capriciousness, acting arbitrarily, ruling without the benefit of analysis, and relying on cases from 1988 and 2000 that, according to plaintiffs, could not reasonably have represented recent developments.
Well, in fairness, doesn't one have to establish an abuse of discretion and arbitrary and capricious decision-making in order to reverse that?
I think abuse of discretion. I think the other adjectives are optional, and I was surprised to see them. In any event, plaintiffs brought this action believing that they had meritorious claims, and I think they were sincere in that, and they realized that they did not. Accordingly, they settled the case in exchange for additional disclosures only, and I think there's nothing wrong with that per se. The disclosures here were modest in nature. Indeed, and I'll talk about them a little bit more in a moment, they weren't even significant enough to warrant a supplemental mailing. They were disclosed only in an 8K that was filed with the SEC. Our brief lists a dozen recent disclosure-only cases where fees were awarded in the range of $2,000 to $400,000. The plaintiff says that the chancellor relied only on two old cases from 21 and 9 years ago, but failed to mention in its brief to this court that just a month before it filed its brief, they were the plaintiffs in two different lawsuits, Curigen and Fibernet, both decided in November of 2009, each involving corrective disclosures and each awarding attorneys' fees and expenses of $200,000. The fee here was obviously double that amount, and you know, how they could have made that argument and said that the chancellor relied on old cases without even citing, you know, cases from a month ago that they were involved in that are directly on point, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Nakbar, are you aware of any precedent where we have a disclosure type of settlement that doesn't result in any payment to the stockholders, where rather than leaving the fee determination up to the court, someone simply agrees to pay a fixed fee, you know, without court involvement? And I asked the question to distinguish it from a situation where you create a common fund and the fee is going to be paid out of the common fund and you need some judicial involvement to see what, if any, money should be taken out of the fund. Here, there was no money going to the stockholders. It was simply a question of paying a fee, but it was left to the court.
Yeah, first of all, I think the cases say that in the Goodrich case, is the one that says the court must review all the awards. So I think that answers the question. And I think plaintiffs concede that. In fact, they accused us of attacking a straw man when we addressed that issue. But I want to correct one thing. The fees here do affect the class. This was a stock-for-stock merger. The class received PNC shares. They wound up owning 18.71% of the combined company. So every dollar of fees affects the class to the tune of 18.7 cents. So it is like a common fund in that sense.
So you're talking about a reduction in stockholder equity?
Yes, exactly. It comes directly out of the stockholder equity. Since I'm allotted 7 minutes, I don't have time to go through all of the disclosures that they say were so valuable, but defendants helpfully characterized the disclosures in their brief as follows, and I'm quoting from page 15 of the opening brief. These disclosures made clear that NCC faced an immediate severe liquidity crisis and possible failure if it did not find a transaction partner within a matter of days. That's plaintiff's own characterization of the value of what it brought to the table. Now let's see what the original merger proxy statement before these additional disclosures said about the company's liquidity crisis and possible failure and the reasons for the merger. We begin at page 43 of the proxy statement, and it says that on October 19, the NCC board determined that it was likely that the National City would not be permitted to participate in the Treasury Department's Capital Purchase Program, or CPP. By October 24, as reported in the original proxy statement, without the benefit of the additional disclosures that they take credit for, management, according to the original proxy, entered into the PNC transaction because of, quote, management's view that it was highly doubtful that National City would be permitted to participate in the CPP, management's view that TARP would not be implemented in a time frame useful to National City, the substantial uncertainty of full access to the liability guarantee program with respect to National City senior lending, holding company, and bank debt, the communications from federal regulators with respect to the merger, and National City's prospects in the absence of announcing a transaction. The next page, page 47 of the proxy statement, which I believe is page 499 in Appendix BD, Defendant's Appendix, lists the board's reasons for recommending the merger. These included limited strategic alternatives available to National City and the likely unavailability of additional capital, which, and I quote, could jeopardize National City's viability as an independent institution going forward. So there was no mystery about this. The company was in bad financial shape. And the additional disclosures maybe put some color around that, but they didn't fundamentally change anything. They didn't justify an award, I don't think, of even $400,000, but certainly $400,000 was well within the discretion of the chancellor. He articulated the reasons for that, and you know, we think he should be affirmed. I see my time is up, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Long, you have about 13 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court again, Brian Long on behalf of plaintiffs below, appellees. We're here today also as cross-appellants with respect to the appeal of the Court of Chancery's decision finding that the settlement was fair, adequate, and reasonable. I'd note first for the record that in no way has counsel for appellants in any way offered any sort of evidence, argument, or suggestion that the Court of Chancery's conclusion that the business judgment rule applies to the acts of National City's directors in approving the transaction with PNC should be rebutted. I'd also note that with respect to the claims that have been discussed and raised in the papers, there's nothing that's been said, as far as I can tell, that would take the conduct of the directors of National City outside the scope of the exculpatory charter provision that the company had adopted pursuant to Section 102b7 of the Delaware General Corporation Law. National City found itself in a terse and fluid economic market when it agreed to the transaction with PNC. Shortly after the transaction was announced, we filed our complaint, believing that we had more than colorable claims based, among other things, on the financial terms of the transaction and the process leading thereto. The Chancellor, on page 7 of his opinion, agrees that we properly instituted our action. After obtaining expedited discovery, including taking the adversarial deposition, one of the directors, and in consultation with our financial consultant, we realized that the strength of our claims was not near what we had originally thought when we filed the complaint. As such, we began negotiations concerning a settlement with the defendants, and I think the record's clear that these were adversarial settlement negotiations, and I'd also like to emphasize that they were done by the book. And what I mean by that, Your Honors, what I mean by that is that the settlement negotiations proceeded in what I would call a two-step process. First, the parties negotiated the substantive terms of the settlement. the disclosures, the scope of the release, the terms of the stipulation of settlement. Only then, after the parties had completed negotiations on the substantive terms, did we begin our negotiations concerning the fee.
Well, with regard to the settlement and the disclosures that you negotiated, isn't a fair reading of the disclosures notice to the shareholders that they should take what PNC was offering? Is there anything in the disclosures that would cause a reasonable shareholder to reach a different conclusion?
What's been referred to as a gotcha disclosure?
No, I'm not. It's not a rhetorical question, and you know, I'm not suggesting any pejorative implications. I just want to know if any disclosure suggested they should vote no, because I think, at least the way I read them, all the disclosures would seem to point towards taking the PNC offer.
I'd like to offer one example, if I might, that, while not what I would call a gotcha disclosure, might cut against the shareholders of National City necessarily voting in favor of the transaction. And that disclosure isn't a disclosure that was agreed to in connection with the settlement, but it is a disclosure that was made after we filed an amended pleading with proxy claims, with disclosure claims in it. And the disclosure to which I'm referring is that for the first time after we asserted a claim about the compensation to Goldman Sachs, the banker for PNC, or excuse me, for National City, for the first time, it was disclosed that $22 million out of the $25 million that Goldman Sachs was paid in connection with its service to National City was contingent upon a consummation of the transaction.
Well, let me look at it from a different perspective. I understand when you file a suit and someone does something unilaterally, it can be attributed to your suit, and that's helpful when you get to the attorney's fees. So we're not talking about that. My question is, how would you, if you negotiated these disclosures, just tell me in plain English how they helped the shareholders.
They helped the shareholders first and foremost by allowing them to better understand the process that led to the transaction.
And if they did, what would they conclude?
They would conclude that under the circumstances, the National City Board of Directors had little choice but to agree to the transaction.
And you don't think they knew that without these additional disclosures?
I think that the disclosures provided beneficial material information to the shareholders in helping them reach that conclusion.
Well, then it seems on the record we're at the point where the directors made their own disclosures and said you ought to vote in favor of the PNC transaction we're recommending. And you had additional disclosures that reinforced the wisdom of that recommendation.
Correct, which the Court of Chancery held was sufficient consideration to justify the release of claims that was agreed to in connection with the settlement.
Okay, great. That's the way I read your brief. I understand it.
Sure. So, turning then just briefly back to the settlement, my final comment would simply be that I don't think there's any suggestion, credible argument that the Court of Chancery actually abused its discretion in approving the settlement. Again, nothing to rebut the presumption that the business judgment rule would apply, nothing to take the conduct outside the scope of 102B7 with respect to our cross appeal. Again, as I said, the negotiations here, we think, were on the fee and the settlement were by the book. Not to be ignored is the fact that not only were we settling the claims in the Delaware action, but also involved in the settlement were other cases pending in Ohio. In the opinion, we submit that the Court of Chancery abused its discretion by failing to give any weight to the agreement of the parties. It mentions the parties reach an agreement concerning the fees, but it really doesn't take any time to really consider, and it doesn't give any weight to that opinion.
All right, but let's factor that into the record. And I'd like you to respond to Mr. Nakbar's argument. He's marshaled some cases, eight or so, that say in this type of settlement, the range of fees, $150,000 to $400,000. And your contention is that your fee, which was at the high end of that range, was inadequate. Now, is the primary reason that your fee was inadequate because of this arm's length negotiations between the parties about the fee, or because you did something that sets you apart from this $150,000 to $400,000 range of cases?
Well, I want to make clear that we don't agree that the range was $150,000 to $400,000. I'd also like to point out
that... Did you cite other cases?
We did. We cited in our papers far more recent opinions in disclosure-only settlements that paid or where fees were awarded that were far in excess.
Just tell me the name of one of them.
Sure. The Union Bancal case.
And there was no money went to the shareholders at all?
It was a disclosure settlement. No money went to the shareholders.
And what was the fee?
$1.25 million was awarded by Vice Chancellor Strine.
Okay, so go back to the argument in this case.
So my argument in that regard is that the settlement here was negotiated by highly experienced practitioners who often practice in the Court of Chancery and who often negotiate the settlement of these sorts of cases in the Court of Chancery. And this was an adversarial and arm's-length negotiation.
Mr. Long, one can read your brief in the cross-appeal to take the position, although I'm not sure you come out and say it directly, that the court should give 100% weight to a negotiated fee where the negotiation is at arm's length between two independent parties. Is that
your position? No, Your Honor.
Well, then your position must be that the court either misapplied a rule of law or found the facts incorrectly in order to get to an abuse of discretion. And I'm having trouble identifying exactly what you're saying the court didn't do but should have done.
In awarding a fee, the court obviously considers the factors enunciated under Sugar Land. But as we set forth in our papers, there are other factors that the court can consider. I think our papers include numerous references to pronouncements from the Court of Chancery that in considering and awarding fees, it will often look to the agreement of the parties as I think one of the ones was.
Okay, well, the court was aware that there was an agreement.
The court was aware that there
and,
was an agreement.
And didn't honor that agreement in its own discretion to determine what was a reasonable fee, as has happened in the past in many cases where there was an agreement between the settling parties on the amount of a fee.
So
what is the court supposed to do to avoid abusing its discretion?
Our position is that the court didn't give any weight whatsoever to this opinion. It didn't consider it at all in light of its prior pronouncements.
And on what basis can you argue that the court didn't give it any weight because it didn't talk about it anymore in its opinion?
There's no reference in the opinion whatsoever, as far as I can tell, that the court the court gave that agreement any weight. And to be clear, this isn't a situation where we had a common fund.
Well, suppose the court did give it weight, whatever weight it thought was appropriate, but simply didn't set down whatever its analysis was of that particular issue. How are we to know?
Well, I think that's part of the arguments that we're making in connection with our cross-appeal, that the court didn't consider the opinion. It didn't provide any detailed analysis regarding whether or not it considered or gave any weight to the opinion, and that we're arguing.
So if the court doesn't deal with the agreement in some explicit way in the opinion, that you're arguing that it must be presumed that the court ignored the agreement.
There's nothing that I can point to in the opinion that reflects that the court gave any weight or consideration in that regard to the...
Well, as I understand it, the agreement was there'd be no opposition to a fee up to $1.2 million. So
right.
That was the maximum, and it was up to the court to select an appropriate fee within the range. And one way to characterize your argument is that it was at the low end of the range. But your argument seems to be it should have been the top of the range. So tell me exactly, if the court came in at $800,000, would that have been all right because it was closer to the high end of the range, or what exactly was the problem?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't know what the court would have said in granting a fee in that regard. Um, think what needs to be said is that the counsel for fiduciary counselors in the court would have applied some sort of heightened standard to reviewing the fee, as we argue in our papers, that doesn't necessarily, shouldn't apply here because there's no common fund and there's no evidence of collusion, no evidence of bad faith, no evidence of improper conduct, anything like that. So to apply some sort of heightened standard was an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Rochelle Silverberg on behalf of the PNC Financial Services Group, arguing on behalf of all defendants. In order to prevail on their objection, the objectors must show that the Chancellor abused his discretion in approving the settlement. The record clearly shows that he did not. The Vedas objectors' main point in the argument today was that the settlement of this claim released their claims in Ohio, which they said were valuable claims. But the fiduciary claims alleged in Ohio are fundamentally the same fiduciary claims that were alleged in Delaware, which the Chancellor correctly found lacked any probability of success on the merits. The crux of the fiduciary claim in Ohio is that the National City Board of Directors breached their fiduciary duties by engaging in an inadequate process and in their consideration and approval of the PNC transaction.
So the Chancellor concluded, at best, the claims would have been exculpated under 102b7.
Correct.
And as I read your brief, there's nothing in the evidence to suggest to the contrary. So we're in a situation where there was either no breach, or if a breach occurred, it would be gross negligence and exculpated. Therefore, the fiduciary claim in Ohio had no value.
Correct. And the plaintiffs do not contest that PNC was the highest bidder out there for National City. They do contest whether or not a standalone option was a viable option. But as Justice Berger pointed out, the message loud and clear from the regulators was that National City very likely would not be getting government assistance through the TARP of the CPP. Again, the board requested to talk to the regulators. The regulators said no. Instead, they sent the October 19th memo, making clear that it was very likely National City would not be receiving aid. On October 22nd, the directors again requested that their counsel ask the regulators to speak with the board. The regulators said no. On that record, we believe that the board, this is a business judgment case, we do not believe that the board could be held liable for its decision that a standalone option was not a viable option.
But isn't there additional record evidence in support of your position that they were also told they could expect to have problems with the FDIC?
Correct, Your Honor. And I would also note that the supplemental disclosures that were negotiated as part of this settlement, in fact, did provide additional DCF information with respect to the standalone option. Again, something that the Vedas objectors contest was not sufficiently disclosed. In the 8K filed in settlement of this action, the National City disclosed that on October 19th, the Board of Directors discussed an illustrative discounted cash flow analysis of National City prepared by Goldman Sachs under the standalone option, which resulted in a range of illustrative value indications of National City that was higher than the aggregate consideration ultimately offered by PNC in the merger. However, the standalone option was not deemed to be feasible under the circumstances for a variety of reasons, including that it was dependent on government assistance. So again, the option of a standalone, the fact that it was considered and the results of that DCF analysis was actually then disclosed to the shareholders as part of the settlement in this action.
So your argument has two points. The first is the record doesn't support that there would ever be an offer that was superior to PNC.
Correct, Your Honor.
And second, there was no standalone option.
Can we go back for a moment, Ms. Silverberg, to the Ohio federal securities action? I just have a procedural question about it. That's a federal Section 14A proxy claim and complaining of disclosure violations. We're told that if that suit had succeeded on the merits, that there would have been a dollar recovery. Is that would that have been a consequence of the misdisclosures, or would it have been a consequence of the state law fiduciary duty claim that was somehow appended to the Ohio suit?
I would say neither. I dispute the notion that there was any additional value that could be obtained for the shareholders for the reasons discussed just before. Namely, there was no one willing to pay more for the company, and standalone option was not an option.
Right. I'm just asking, though, as a matter of theory in the complaint, in order to get that kind of a recovery from a disclosure case, there has to be some basis for it, and I'm just trying to explore whether there was any theoretical basis.
The objectors have not provided any basis either for their $1.1 billion claim or for any heightened value above the value paid for PNC in this transaction. And beyond that, the three alleged non-disclosures from their complaint, they claim, one, the failure to disclose derivative liability, two, the lack of customary financial analysis, and three, the details of the due diligence performed by PNC. Issues of derivative liability were both disclosed in the original proxy as well as supplemental disclosures on that point in the 8K. And again,
putting aside the merits, is it accurate or not accurate to say that both the disclosure claims and the fiduciary duty claims that were alleged in the Ohio suit were substantially the same as what was being alleged in Delaware?
The Delaware claims were clearly the same claims, though with a different emphasis on facts. And again, the disclosure claims were essentially the same, though there was an emphasis on the derivative liability in Ohio, which was not emphasized as much in the Delaware case, but again, fully disclosed in the proxy and the 8K, as well as discussion of financial analyses. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We asked you a lot of questions. Mr. Cochran has yielded a minute to you, and we'll give you a total of 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I haven't heard anyone contest the argument that I made that the Chancellor did not comply with Présente, that there were no explicit factual findings on the record with respect to the Rule 23 requirements. And that's, again, very important because it's a non-opt-out class, and the release was extremely broad. And as you know, this Court has indicated in the past that it should give particular scrutiny to overbroad releases. So the Court did not do that, and that's a de novo standard. PNC's counsel indicated that the only standard that we're up against today is an abuse of discretion. I think that's not the case. Secondly, what is on the record, I might add, is indicates or suggests inadequacy of counsel. Chancellor Chandler indicated the minuscule and meager benefits of the disclosures. He indicated that plaintiff's counsel did not press any motion after they obtained expedited discovery, took one deposition before the MOU was signed. The MOU was signed 3 weeks after the amended complaint was filed. And no deposition lasted more than 4 hours. So I think those are things on the record in the July 31st, 2009 order that do suggest inadequacy of counsel. With respect to the issue that Your Honors raised earlier about, is there any evidence in the record whether any other merger partner other than PNC would have emerged? Well, I submit that there is. The deposition of Goldman Sachs representative Mr. Mahoney was taken, and he was specifically asked, did Goldman Sachs have a view that an acquisition of NCC was the only or the best alternative? He testified, no, that's not our opinion. We don't express an opinion on that part. So, well, did you look at other alternatives? We did. And one of the telling aspects of Mr. Mahoney's testimony was he said that in October of 2008, during this alleged critical time, Goldman Sachs did not contact any third party regarding an asset sale. And that was something that people viewed as a possibility. An asset sale might allow NCC to raise the requisite liquidity. That could result in a higher value down the line. Also, there was an analysis going on about the good bank, bad bank scenario. That was also a possibility for NCC. Goldman Sachs also testified at the deposition in this case that it did not contact any third parties to explore the good bank, bad bank scenario. So there is evidence that there was a lack of effort made to explore those significant alternatives that might have provided significantly higher value to NCC shareholders. With respect to the issue of the federal proxy claims, again, it's undisputed that the Chancellor did not undertake on the record any effort to value those claims. We can sit here and argue about did they have value, did they not have value, but the fundamental fact is it wasn't explored, it wasn't undertaken at the trial court level. And in the MCA case...
Well, based on what we've been told, the Ohio claims and the Delaware claims were essentially the same, except the Ohio disclosure claims were denominated as Section 14A claims rather than as common law duty of candor claims. So,
well, I disagree. The 14A claims are not subject to a business judgment rule defense. They're not subject to the exculpatory provision. The source of the duty is a federal statute, not common law.
That's correct. That's why I asked whether if there was a recovery that could be obtained in the Ohio suit, whether that recovery would come as a consequence of adjudicated disclosure violations, or whether it would require also an adjudication of a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, I believe if the record had been established, the record can lead to facts that should have been disclosed that might have changed the mind of the NCC shareholders as to vote or not vote. If they don't vote in favor of the transaction, they decide we don't want to take this paltry $2.23 a share. Who knows what would have happened? That's speculative. But if the
company that would be a transaction that would be prevented, as opposed to a transaction that would be undone or that would be the subject of some affirmative dollar recovery.
Well, the damages in 14A are determined based on lack of disclosure, and if you can tie, after litigating your case and having the benefit of discovery, tie the alleged disclosures to a monetary value that was harmed, it's tied to the disclosure, then you have the claim. But again, the Chancellor Chandler primarily focused in saying that Delaware claims were weak on the business judgment rule defense and the 102B7 exculpatory provision, which don't exist in the 14A claim. So, and again, the Chancellor didn't make that evaluation, and because of that, and because there was no right to opt out, and because the release was extremely broad, we believe that the Chancellor applied the wrong legal standard because he did not value those 14A claims. And that's what the courts say in the MCA case and the Countrywide case, that the court must value those claims that are being released.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.